the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez. A California Senate bill aiming to drastically increase housing growth is back on the legislative table. It was shelved last year when cities like Los Angeles pushed back, but the revamped version of the bill gives local governments what Janet Jackson used to always want, and that's control. That and a lot more coming up on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Hope your week is going swell so far. Coming up on today's show, we break down how Coachella's lineup is looking more international, but at the same time, we'll have fewer big-name women taking to the stage. Plus, the work to gather a surprising first for Los Angeles, a finely detailed map of how each part of the region might react differently to an earthquake.
So it could be that you have a building on one block and you go another block over, and it's subject to a different level of shaking.
We're going to take you inside the Caltech lab where that's happening in about 20 minutes. But first is third time the charm for SB 50. That's that ambitious housing bill that would force neighborhoods to allow taller, denser housing near public transportation and job centers in California. It's by State Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco, who spoke about it earlier today on KPCC's Air Talk.
SB 50 is going to result in a lot more affordable housing being built in cities. And we want to make sure that as affordable housing is built in our communities, that people who live in that community have first dibs.
Now, the thing is, the bills failed to pass twice before. Here to break down what's new with this version and its chances this time around, we have Hannah Wiley, legislative reporter with the Sacramento Bee. Hannah, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, this history of the bill is a little fraught. Remind us why Scott Wiener thinks the heart of this bill is still a good idea.
Right. So the previous two attempts fell flat simply because the legislature agreed or couldn't agree that local control was still front and center of the bill. And so Senator Wiener released amendments yesterday that hands back a lot of authority to local governments who were concerned that SB 50 stripped them of their local zoning laws. So that's why Wiener thinks that this is finally the year to get this bill passed through the legislature and to earn Governor Gavin Newsom's signature.
What would the bill do for the housing crisis, or what is it projected or expected to do for the housing crisis?
Sure. Well, Senator Wiener has made the argument that Senate Bill 50 is the most consequential bill to spur development because it would require local governments to plan for additional units to help alleviate the 3.5 million unit deficit California is currently facing. So SB 50 would now serve more as a guideline for local governments to look at and say, we know we need to build X amount of housing to meet our necessary quota. And we have to do that around transit and jobs-rich areas so that we keep people from making long commutes, we keep people near job-rich opportunity zones, et cetera. And so higher, the taller units and greater density and multifamily housing would all be built under this mandated legislation.
And Hannah, you mentioned how now it would seem to serve as a guideline. And it seemed like before it felt like for local governments, at least, that it was an order straight from Sacramento. The city council, LA City Council, voted very strongly to reject it. The major sticking points, it was just about all control, right?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, it was for all control. And then a lot of cities, Wiener said that a lot of cities came to him and said, look, we agree with the legislation. We know we need to produce more housing. But the problem is that SB 50 requires us to build new houses the same way throughout California. And what works for Los Angeles might not work for San Francisco. What works for San Francisco might not work for Central Valley communities. So this bill really allows local officials to say, you know, we want to prioritize certain housing in this area and taller housing in this area. As long as they're building the necessary amount of units, then they can kind of figure out where and why they want to put certain units in certain places, as long as they're not prioritizing development in low-income neighborhoods specifically.
Now, the
that
bill
would violate the fair housing rule.
Yeah, the bill also has private sector opponents. Who?
Yeah, so there are groups of realtors that support the legislation. California Association of Realtors, an apartment association group, and really they're on the development side, certainly, which is a point of contention for local community groups who say that this is putting profits over, you know, affordable housing.
We're talking to Hannah Wiley, legislative reporter for the Sacramento Bee, about Senate Bill 50. Now, okay, the new version of the bill introduced a few days ago. Earlier today on Air Talk with Larry Mantle, Scott Weiner said that there will be more local control in this new version.
We now are giving more flexibility to cities to tailor SB 50 to meet their unique needs. And we're doing that by having a 2-year delayed implementation of the bill.
Hannah, can you break down for us what else is different about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So like Senator Weiner said, there's a 2-year delay. And then there's also a 5-year delay specifically for sensitive communities. And that would give them time to figure out how they can construct new houses without displacing residents who have lived there for a long time. So it kind of hints at the gentrification concerns that many community groups expressed previously. The problem is that they still have those concerns. And Senate Bill 50 also allocates a certain number of units, or a certain percentage, I should say, for larger development projects. So about 15 to 25% of the units in a building of 20 or more units would have to be affordable. And that just is also a play by Senator Weiner to appeal to local community groups who are worried about gentrification.
You know, Hannah, wondering, you know, Senator Weiner has really expressed an urgency on this bill. I talked to him not that long ago about it, and he just seemed very, very passionate about this in terms of not only just helping the housing crisis, but changing and maybe saving lives for people to have a place to live. I'm wondering, these delays that are in the new version, how much of a concession you think it was for Weiner?
Well, I think it was a concession that he anticipated, just because it's going to take time to develop blueprints that the state of California will approve that are SB 50 compliant. And it's going to take 5 years at least for communities at risk of gentrification to feel that they have a housing plan that works for their cultural, their community's cultural needs, their community's demographic needs, et cetera. So it is a concession, but it's also a realistic, at least a real minimum, just a couple of years would give these cities a chance to think about how it's going to impact them and what they need to do to make sure that they're compliant with SB 50.
Any sense of what Governor Gavin Newsom thinks of this revamped version?
Right. So Governor Newsom released a press statement last year once SB 50 was halted, saying he was deeply disappointed with the legislature's decision. He has since in recent months hinted that he appreciates the pro-construction idea, like Senator Weiner has touted in SB 50, and he's hoping that Senator Weiner's colleagues in the legislature come over onto that side of things, the pro-construction idea. It also, I should mention, has 4 Republicans signed on to the legislation, which kind of hints at the bipartisan effort here, and it remains to be seen how much Governor Newsom is going to play a role in this debate, but I have a feeling that this might be something he's interested in seeing move through the legislature.
One more thing quickly. If this thing fails again, what do you think Weiner will do? Just push it again?
I think that's a great question. I mean, he certainly made great concessions here to local officials who demanded the greater authority. We'll see. Weiner said that this is his number one priority, so it would not surprise me if this is a hill he continues to battle on with.
Hannah Wiley, legislative reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Hannah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
With this new year, there are new labor laws now in effect for California. That means there could be some changes happening at your very workplace. For more on those changes, we turn to CalMatters economy reporter Judy Lin. We spoke with her earlier and started about asking about the most important laws to know about and what they'll do.
The minimum wage is going up to $12 an hour, and it's $13 if you're at a larger employer. Paid family leave, you will get 2 extra weeks if you're expecting a little one to join your family. It technically kicks in July 1, and then there are other laws that took effect in the new year that are aimed at banning discrimination. One law talks about workers can have braids, dreadlocks, and weaves, and that should not be a point of discrimination for them. There was a deadline for corporations to add women onto their boards, at least one woman. Onto their boards, and that is in effect. At the same time, a lot of these laws are taking effect. There are a lot of court challenges, basically lawsuits flying left and right.
Well, let's get into those. Which one of these laws has received some pushback?
So right off the bat, let's go to the worker classification law, AB 5. That is being challenged in 3 major lawsuits that we're aware of. From the truckers, the Trucking Association has filed suit. The gig companies, particularly Uber and Postmates, have filed a lawsuit. And then freelance writers and reporters in the journalism world, in the publishing world, have also challenged AB 5. What we know right now is that only the truckers have a temporary restraining order. So technically, AB 5 is in effect, except for those in the trucking world, because that's being worked out. Okay. There's a federal preemption challenge from the truckers.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about what happens with these workplace laws when they are challenged in court. Do they get put on hold, or do they just proceed as normal?
It's in effect. Everyone should know, and the state labor secretary, Julie Hsu, is making it clear AB 5 is in effect. There's no grace period for employers. They should start shifting their workers from giving them 1099 tax forms to W-2s. There's this request by the state to have employers go ahead and voluntarily make that transition. At the same time, you have Uber, Postmates, you know, very open about their challenge, saying they will not follow this, and that will play out as the weeks go on.
It's a brand new year. We're talking about brand new labor laws that could be affecting you and your workplace with CalMatters economy reporter Judy Lin. Now, these measures seem to tackle a diverse array of issues. Any common denominator among them?
I would say it's a reflection of California trying to be progressive and trying to not only address income inequality, but discrimination, inequality in all its different forms, right? And this is very much reflective of a more progressive legislature dominated by Democrats and our Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom, in office, who's, you know, very much been an advocate for workers' rights.
Did movements such as Me Too play a role in the creation and implementation of these new laws?
Absolutely. You know, the women on corporate boards is clearly a push to add diversity, point of view, and protection for women. There was a law that was passed, and it was a law that barred applicants from having to submit to mandatory arbitration as a condition of their employment. And it did pass and get signed. Right now, right at the end of the year, a federal judge put a temporary restraining order on it. So while there are these laws that are trying to protect women, they are facing legal challenges. So it's unclear in some of these cases what will happen.
Yeah, the arbitration one seems to be one that has a lot of contention wrapped all around it. And AB 5 as well. It just seems like this has not been a smooth one when it comes to transitioning workplace laws from one year to the next.
Yeah, I mean, this is very much reflective of a legislature that pushed the envelope on workplace protections for women and low-wage workers. And, you know, the business community is, in some cases, are saying, hey, you're going too far. And we have rights as employers, too. And that's literally what's happening in with these lawsuits.
From the perspective of employers, what would you say is the biggest change for them for the workplace?
for them, it's just trying to figure out whether they're how they're supposed to categorize their workers. You know, AB5 I would hold up as like the biggest change. You have it's estimated that more than a million Californians are going to be shifted, and so they've got a lot of basic HR accounting. A lot of businesses will have to figure out if they're supposed to be moving their workers from contractors to employee status, and that's a lot of paperwork, essentially.
And wondering then from the employer's perspective to the employee's perspective, what changes can they expect in the workplace?
I mean, with the change in AB5, I would say it's a shift in mindset. Instead of being your own boss, you become a worker with all the protections that a typical employee has, whether it's access to paid family leave, vacation time, overtime, and chipping in your share of Social Security, Medicare, and paying for all the benefits the rest of us chip into. That is a change on their end, too, in terms of taxes. You know, looking instead of having to do your own withholdings, you now often an employer will do a lot of that estimating for you.
That's Judy Lind, reporter for Cal Matters, covering finances, workforce, and economic issues in California. Judy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And one update to our conversation and the pushback to AB 5. Yesterday, a federal judge in L.A. ruled that freelance journalists and photographers will not be temporarily exempt from the law. Two organizations representing freelancers argue that the law limited free speech since people would be limited to only 35 submissions every year for each media outlet. But the judge said the organizations waited too long to submit a challenge to the restrictions. All right, a Caltech researcher is tracking teeny tiny quakes, the kind that you barely feel. So you might think what the point is, but the goal of the project could wind up saving lives.
If you're going to anticipate where earthquakes are going to cause damage, you need a map like this. And this could be important, for example, how first responders might deal with an earthquake.
We'll take a look at the equipment in his lab at Caltech when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Although we are the land of earthquakes, L.A. has never had a dense seismological survey. That's the nuanced information about how the earth moves underneath us. However, one researcher at Caltech is preparing to change that. Later this year, researcher Rob Clayton will launch a project to blanket the Los Angeles basin with seismic sensors, these portable white cylinders the size of metal water bottles, and are stuck in the ground by the long metal spikes at their base. Now, through these spikes, the sensors will gather data on an unprecedented scale all over the region, which in turn will provide us with better insight into how to improve infrastructure as well as assess hazards in each area. I went to visit Clayton at his office in the fall as he was finalizing his plans for the survey, and he kicked off the conversation by telling me exactly where he planned to set the sensors.
So it's going all the way from Santa Monica, downtown Los Angeles, those kind of areas down towards Compton, Carson, Long Beach, Seal Beach, and over into communities in Orange County also. And then all the way up to along Plenty Hills, so as Whittier and then those various communities along there too. What's above this that we're not covering on this survey is the cities like Pasadena and those ones up in the next valley over. So approximately 20,000 locations. If we have a pool of 5,000 instruments, we could start at one end, and then after each instrument has sat in the ground for 35 days, we could pick it up, take the data off of it, recharge the instrument, and put it back at effectively the front of the pack. Hmm. And so the pack would roll across the basin, and we figure that will happen in about 4 months.
4 months to do that. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are you looking for there?
The main thing is to actually determine the main measure of strength of the surface. So it's the thing that's going to govern the shaking that goes on and the ability of the Earth to amplify signals coming from earthquakes. And that's one of the things we've noticed over the last decade is that focusing of energy varies laterally by a significant amount. So the current stations that are in there, and there's about 10 of them over the whole Los Angeles basin, can't really represent this motion very well. We need a very, very dense survey to capture all this variation. So it could be that you have a building on one block and you go another block over, and it's subject to a different level of shaking than even though
just one block over.
Yeah. So this we learned from an oil company deployment that was done in Long Beach and a couple of others since then. But that oil company deployment actually happened to record an earthquake. When we looked at the variation in strength of that earthquake across 5,000 receivers just in the city of Long Beach, it was amazing at the level of variation that occurred. And so that's what opened our eyes to the idea that, wow, there's a lot of variation going on there that we need to capture.
Most people, Doctor, wouldn't think that. They would think that, well, if it shakes somewhere, that's it. That's what it is in that whole area. But they wouldn't think that there's layers and variations to it.
Right. And so a lot of the shaking depends on what's in that last little bit of soil that you're standing on. Parts of the earthquake strength depend on the source, of course, and on the overall basin structure we sit in. But part, a good significant part of it depends on the last few, I'll say, tens or hundreds of meters of soil or rock that you're standing on. And that's where the lateral variation occurs. And that's what I believe is missing in our current surveys, is we don't have a good map of that function.
So on a practical level, why is it important to have that information?
If you're going to anticipate where earthquakes are going to cause damage, you need a map like this. And this could be important, for example, how first responders might deal with an earthquake. If they know there's zones of the city that are subject to heavy shaking, then that would be an immediate alert that they might want to look in those areas first. Also, when it comes to construction of future building infrastructure, you might want to try and avoid zones like this. And particularly, we're concerned with institutions and infrastructure that have a lot of their facilities spread out over a long area. And among these are power companies, water companies, gas pipeline companies. Take pipeline, for example. Mm-hmm. They have pipelines all over Los Angeles, and they could break at any point. And so it would be interesting to know where they would be important to know where they are breaking and where they need to go to service that. Possibly in sort of a looking ahead mode, they might want to strengthen pipes in certain areas where they cross faults.
Now, when it comes to the actual magnitude of the quakes, does it matter what you're measuring at this point?
We usually will measure small ones. And these things are very sensitive instruments. Mm-hmm. So we, because of the density, should be able to go down to magnitudes 1.5 to 1 or something like that. Far less than humans would actually feel. But nevertheless, it indicates active structures that are giving off earthquakes that might generate a larger one in the future.
So, Doctor, I can already picture and hear people say, well, if you're going to be measuring earthquakes of magnitude less than 2, I mean, why do we need to know? I mean, people in L.A. yawn if it's not 4.0 or above.
Well, in Los Angeles, it could be that there are structures down there that are active that we're not aware of. And we hope that they expose themselves by having these tiny little earthquakes that a dense network like we're proposing could actually measure.
We're in the office of Caltech Professor of Geophysics, Dr. Rob Clayton. What do you got in front of us here, this equipment that we're looking at?
This is a seismic sensor. It was first used in Los Angeles around 2011, and it really revolutionized the way that oil companies and now academia are doing surveys within a populated area like Los Angeles. So this thing is a completely autonomous sensor in that you may notice it's got a long pointy end on it.
Yeah.
You just stick it in the ground.
Oh, that's simple. Just stick it in the ground.
Walk away from it.
Okay.
About a month later, you come back and pick it up, and it's been recording motions all that time. So if you're an oil company, you have some type of an active source, like a vibrator truck or something like that out working. If you're an academic person like myself, you use natural sources like earthquakes, or even the ocean is actually our main source of energy. The waves crashing on the beach effectively propel enough energy into these systems that we can actually use them. So the reason why, of course, they're so useful in an urban environment, there's no cables. No cables connecting them to each other.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
And they don't try and transmit anything either. That would just wear on the battery of it. So it'll last about 35 days just on its own.
So that when you stick it in the ground, what are you hoping to record?
Well, we want to record ground motion, so literally the shaking of the ground that goes on. Now, that can be caused by earthquakes, which we would then, over being recorded by a number of these receivers, we'd then be able to locate the earthquake and figure out where it was. Or if it is ambient noise and ocean waves, we can actually cross-correlate the energy we see on this one with all of the other ones that are out there and get a coherent picture of waves moving back and forth. And that's somewhat like the picture that was in here. And that allows us to actually map the structure. So they're both useful for locating earthquakes and for mapping the structure.
Should people feel a little more comforted to know that more information is better? Because sometimes people don't want to know. We live in Southern California. We have fires. We have earthquakes. We have all these things that people want to put out of their head. But to know that information is being compiled, what kind of solace should people get out of knowing that this information is being processed and compiled?
Well, I think we'll achieve a situation awareness much quicker for an earthquake than we have been able to previously. Of all the kinds of catastrophes that we handle, fires and that kind of thing, earthquakes are the ones that leave us sort of without information for the longest period of time. We know there was shaking, and then there's this big pause that goes on. Well, how bad was it? Well, we can give you a magnitude, but, well, how much damage? That's the part that we don't know yet, and it takes a long time to assess that. But with this type of information, you can make those assessments fairly quickly, I think. At least get a ballpark figure of how bad the thing was and what we need to do.
Well, Dr. Clayton, thanks for having us here at your office at Caltech. That was really, really fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
Shake. Shake.
All right, here at Take Two, we love going out and visit and hang with our listeners. We think of you as partners in what we do here on the radio, and one of the best examples of that partnership is our segment that's sweeping the county, and that's 88 Cities. That's when you invite us to visit your city, one of the 88 in Los Angeles County. And coming up, we head 25 miles east of us on the 210 and visit La Vergne. Get to know La Vergne when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, lots more news to get to all afternoon long here on KPCC, and we have the host of All Things Considered, Nick Roman, here to fill us in on what you'll be getting into.
We got a lot of stuff this afternoon. The LAPD is investigating a number of Metro Division officers accused of filing phony traffic stop reports to boost gang numbers. Robert Grova will have that story. Also, men of color who teach in California public schools could be the key to closing the achievement gap for boys of color. But here's the thing. Fewer than 10% of the state's school teachers are men of color.
That's it? Wow.
Yeah, we'll look at the efforts to hire and keep those men in California schools. And also, Facebook says it's going to ban deepfake videos from its website. Of course, Facebook's been criticized for failing to control some of the content on its platform. We'll look at how this ban could be enforced. You'll hear it all on All Things Considered at 4 o'clock after Marketplace at 3 and The Frame at 3:30.
My whole Facebook profile is a fake. I don't use my radio name on my the real name. So yeah, if you see me there on Facebook, it's not me.
Well, I'm not on Facebook at
all.
You're
not on Facebook?
No,
really?
Wow. No, I'm afraid.
You're on TikTok or something.
No.
Some new app. Right?
I am on Instagram.
You are? Wow. Yeah. What's the Instagram handle?
Roman on the Radio.
There you go. And I'm A. Martinez, LA. So there you go. All right, Nick, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm Martinez. We've been exploring every single city in LA County. It's for our series 88 Cities, where the tour guides are you. We've been to Glendale and Torrance, Agoura Hills and Arcadia. And today we replay for you the time we went 30 miles east of downtown LA to the edge of the Pomona Valley. Today, La Vergne. This quaint city of 32,000 rests in the foothills of the San Bernardino mountain range just north of the LA County Fairgrounds. Now, it used to be called the heart of the Orange Empire, with orange groves sweeping across the landscape. Over time, though, fruit diseases and the demand for homes squeezed out the groves to the handful that remain. But you might know the city more for its history of wedding crashers. A church here was where Dustin Hoffman's Ben Braddock whisked away Elaine from the altar in The Graduate. What brings us here today, though, is a different church. It's one that planted the seeds for the city to become what it is today. And our guide is 24-year-old Katrina Beltran. Katrina, hi.
Thank you so much for making the drive out to this tiny city that almost no one knows about.
Oh, well, you know about it, so you're going to tell us all about it. Now, okay, you were born and raised here with a brief stint on the East Coast for college. How would you describe what it's like?
It's really just a small college town that's a bedroom city, but there's a lot to do.
You say that with a smile on your face, though, as if there's not much to do.
The city has really grown since I grew up. With the college expanding over the last, I'd say, 10 years or so, the downtown area has grown. It's gotten some new businesses, and the downtown has really just been revitalized.
So is it fair to say that the college, University of Laverne, has helped drive the economy a bit here in the city?
The university has a lot of commuter students, so people from the area are drawn to Laverne, and that's what makes them tend to gravitate towards the university. And likewise, there's a lot of people who come to the university, and that revitalizes the city.
Okay, you sold us on the idea of visiting Laverne because there's a story to how a church helped make modern Laverne. But the story of this city starts way back in 1887. It was called Lordsburg, but it wasn't named after the Lord. Tell us about its founder, Isaac Wilson Lord.
Yeah, so it's not the Lord, but it's a Lord. He was a developer from Los Angeles, and he convinced the Santa Fe Railroad Company to build a train depot here in Laverne. So he built up a lot of lots. He created this giant hotel, but unfortunately, by the time he was done, the land boom had ended, and so there was no one that wanted to stay here.
I see right across from us, there's a sign that says Lordsburg. We were walking past another sign that said Lordsburg Townsite. So a lot of the remnants of Lordsburg still remain here in Laverne.
Yeah, unfortunately, the original Lordsburg Hotel isn't here, but there are still a lot of nods. Lordsburg Tap House and Grill, they have a wall of taps of beer, and they also have old train memorabilia for when there was a train depot just down the street.
Let's go inside. Maybe they got some stuff we can take a look at.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, Katrina, what are we looking at? Because it looks really cool, all these little trains.
Yeah, so we're inside the bar right now, and there's this big display case that has a lot of vintage pictures of the Laverne Depot and the different kind of cars that traveled here on the Santa Fe Pacific Railway.
Now, we were looking around for pictures of the hotel. We don't seem to have any in this bar. Do you have any ideas of what it used to look like?
So you kind of have to think about late 1800s architecture. So it was pretty built up. I think it was either two or three stories, and it kind of had a little bit of an Art Deco style roof. But like I said earlier, it was never used.
All right, Katrina, since Lord's idea was a big old bust, Lordsburg needed some salvation. So let's walk over to where they got that from.
Let's head over there now.
This is 88 Cities, where we get an insider's tour of each of LA's 88 cities. Those insiders are you. And today, KPCC listener Katrina Beltran is with me, showing us her hometown of Laverne. Now, we just walked a few blocks to this beautiful Gothic church with towering cement. It's called the Church of the Brethren. Katrina, how did the creation of this church help save Lordsburg?
So, as we were talking earlier, we mentioned the Lordsburg Hotel. Really, there wasn't anyone out here really traveling back and forth anymore. People had lost interest in this land. Well, a couple of brethren men were out here scouting for a new college, and they came through Laverne, loved the location, thought it would be a great place to start a new university, and they ended up buying the former Lordsburg Hotel and about 100 other plots of land, and that was really what founded the University of Laverne.
Wow. All right. Now, after Isaac Lord died, the citizens moved to change the city's name to Laverne. That's a French reference to the area's green foothills. Your story, Katrina, is that your grandfather, Chuck Boyer, was once the senior pastor of this very church, the church that we're standing in right now. So what are the church's values?
A big part of the Church of the Brethren are their pacifist values. And specifically here in Laverne, inclusion and equality are two of the biggest values.
So you mentioned how plots of land were bought up to create the University of Luverne. How has the church been responsible for the growth of University of Luverne since it started it?
Well, a lot of people in the Midwest, because that's where, like, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, that's where a majority of the Brethren folk were. And so having the idea of there's a school in California, so retired farmers decided to come out here and retire, as well as bring their families over here and give their kids a good Christian college upbringing.
All right, so let's take a tour inside the church itself and meet its current head pastor.
Yeah.
Hello, Pastor Boyer.
Yes.
Hi, Martinez, KPCC.
Nice to meet you.
Pastor Susan Boyer leads the congregation of Church of the Brethren, and by the way, no relation to Katrina's grandfather, Pastor Chuck Boyer. Can you give us a tour of this building? It looks amazing from the outside. I would love to see it on the inside.
I would love to.
All right, great. Let's go inside. Pastor, I grew up in a traditional Catholic church. Mm-hmm. It has the same feel of a Catholic church.
It does because it's large. It pulls your eye up.
We're standing where all the pews are. What are we seeing as we look toward the pulpit?
We have a installation of peace cranes, all in white, coming down from the ceiling. And it's the ceiling is covered in stars. And if you look closely enough, you see Saturn every once in a while. As you can see, we have rainbow flags up because inclusion is extremely important to this congregation. And we have a peace pole with peace on earth written in different languages. We put signs in the yard about our neighbors. We don't care where you're from, we're glad you're our neighbors.
Pastor Boyer, what role would you say the church plays in the community here in Luverne today?
Well, as I mentioned before, the Brethren value humility and simplicity, so it's hard for me to...
To boast?
To boast. The presence has to do with those values again. One of the things that this congregation did when Katrina's grandfather was the pastor was he was here during 9/11. Did you talk about that?
I didn't talk about it yet.
Yeah, so he called the local Muslim school and said, is there a way that we can be present with you right now? And they said, yes, can you come and accompany the children into school and out of the school? And they did that for weeks. And then,
were they feeling threatened?
Yeah, they were. And then after the San Bernardino shootings, I called them again, and we provided presents for about a two-week period outside of the gates at the time school got out every day. And so what we offer to this community is those values of caring for the earth, of inclusion, of interfaith work.
Now, Katrina, Pastor Boyer mentioned the progressive nature of this church's values. An interesting story about the church involves your grandfather, Pastor Chuck Boyer, way back in 1993. He actually caused controversy by being the first leader in the denomination to say he welcomed LGBT people into the faith and would be open to them taking leadership roles. Katrina, what does that say to you about how being here in Luverne and in Southern California maybe shaped the values of the organization?
Yeah, well, technically it happened before I was born, but I've heard the stories all throughout my life where people know me as that's his granddaughter or that's my grandpa. If you talk to like other Brethren people, sometimes they don't like the Luverne church as much, or they have a certain stigma of the California churches. But I think that being out here with all the diversity that we have, and my grandfather seeing that, I don't know how to put it. Sorry.
It's okay.
No, your lip's trembling. You're having a bit of an emotional moment. What? Where are these emotions rooted from?
I miss him a lot. But just the great work that Brethren before have done, and Brethren folk like my grandpa have done to better the community, it's just, it can be a little bit overwhelming.
She had a brave grandfather, and he was a man who had served the denomination as a peace consultant, and he brought that kind of deep care to his work here, and he stood up, and it was hard.
Those values that you both have talked about in the last few minutes, wondering how
those are passed along to people that come to Luverne, newer residents of Luverne?
I see a lot more younger families moving in. Maybe they don't realize how strong the values at the church or the university have set in the city, but that I see a lot of parents volunteering. So the local AYSO, the soccer organization, you see a lot of people who never thought they'd be refereeing or coaching a soccer team or anything like that. They're volunteering to help improve the community, not only for their children, but for the families around them. Or you see older people donating their time, donating their money to lots of different organizations around the city. And that sense of charities is important. And I think a lot of people in Luverne, they know that.
It's a community with so much going on and so much involvement. I think that would be the way I would say that.
That's Pastor Susan Boyer of Church of the Brethren in Luverne. Now, Katrina, as we wrap up, we want to come up with a motto for Luverne. It's not Heart of the Orange Empire anymore, so give us a new one. So picture it this way. Luverne is what?
Well, I want to try to come up with like something catchy now.
Yeah, right.
Because I want to keep that heart in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is such a big heart in Luverne. Luverne has a welcoming heart.
That sounds good to me. That's KPCC listener Katrina Beltran, who showed off her hometown of Luverne. It's part of our series 88 Cities, where we visit each and every city in LA County, and yours could be next. Convince us that you should be the tour guide by telling us the places and history that shaped your hometown. Go to kpcc.org/88cities. All right, Coachella's 2020 lineup has some pretty cool names. Frank Ocean, Travis Scott, but no women headlining, which is strange because Lady Gaga, Beyonce, and Ariana Grande have all done it. Has Coachella turned into Brochella? We'll find out when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Last week, Coachella released its lineup for the 2020 festival this April. It's become a cultural barometer for what's big in music. And on the one hand, there will be more of this. That's Big Bang, one of the many J-pop and K-pop bands will take the stage. But on the other hand, people are criticizing one big misstep, that even though the festival is called Coachella, it might as well be called Brochella. There will be fewer women headliners this year. And joining us to discuss it all is music writer Sherry Hu. Sherry, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, Sherry, why does it stand out to you that this year's Coachella will have more international acts?
So just comparing it to last year, so you mentioned Big Bang. I think last year the only two major Asian groups were Blackpink and then Perfume. And just the fact that the amount of Asian representation has just increased so dramatically this year, not just with the headliners like Big Bang, but also with a lot of solo acts, you know, further down in the lineup. The fact that an all-Asian group like 88 Rising is having its own event at Coachella, I think is super significant. And I think it just signals that the festival organizers are really trying to reach a more diverse audience. A lot of these artists also, not just the Asian artists, but a lot of the other bilingual or international artists have only really come up in the past couple of years. They skew towards having a younger fan base as well. And so trying to reach a younger and also more diverse listener base, that definitely stands out to me.
How much of it, as you mentioned, the organizers trying to reach a larger audience, or just Asian music just becoming such a force that it can't be ignored?
Yeah, and I think K-pop is the most significant example of that, where just in general, the online activity is just so fervent. And so the passion and enthusiasm of the fan base and the ability for those fans to mobilize, especially online, whether it's on Twitter or on any other like social platform in favor of their artists, that's great for a festival where otherwise you can really, you know, only experience the performance at the festival or maybe through the live stream, but then probably the fan bases of Big Bang are going to be posting about it and sharing it and just increasing the reach of that festival as well.
Yeah. Now, one of those Asian artists that's going to be there is Hatsune Miku. Tell us what makes her so special.
For those who don't know about Hatsune Miku, she's actually a hologram, or not maybe technically speaking a hologram, but she's like a virtual star. And they've somehow like taken this girl, Hatsune Miku, on tour. And there are tons of videos online showing how like their fan base is filling up stadiums, especially in Japan and in Asia. And just to be on a lineup as big as Coachella's lineup just signals the fact that maybe, you know, more mainstream audiences are ready to accept that, or just the fact that she'll get that exposure in an international setting is really interesting to me.
Well, considering the wider array and diversity of the lineup, do you think the audience is changing too in terms of the faces and kinds of people and backgrounds that we'll see in the crowd?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you look back to around the mid-2000s, so like 2014, 2015, that was a moment where the Coachella aesthetic really solidified, and you had clothing brands like H&M creating their whole lines of clothes just for Coachella, definitely catering to a mostly white audience, I think. But then I was thinking, like, how does that then mesh or not mesh with the audience for K-pop? Even just looking at like the live stream for Blackpink at Coachella last year, I was struck at how diverse, truly diverse the audience was. So it wasn't just Asian fans in the audience. There were tons of African-American fans, tons of Hispanic, Latin American fans, just like from all kinds of ethnicities and races. And I think that was like truly strategic on Coachella's part, because they realized like, oh, maybe we're kind of reaching a plateau with this stereotypical audience that we're known for attracting. How do we, I guess, position ourselves as being more on the forefront of what's happening globally?
We're talking about Coachella's 2020 lineup with music writer Sherry Hu. Now, just a few years ago, Beyonce blew all of Coachella away. Last year, Ariana Grande was a headliner along with big acts like Janelle Monáe and Solange Knowles, Beyonce's little sister. But for 2020, and I mentioned it at the top, this place might as well be called Brochella, because there is a notable lack of huge female-fronted acts. Does that matter?
Yeah, it's so interesting that Beyonce's headlining show, which was truly historic, was just 2 years ago. And now we're kind of back at this point where, yeah, it's like largely male it's all male in the headliners and largely male kind of in the next line below. I think if anything, it shows that gender inequality in the music industry is truly systemic, and you're seeing it across the board, not just in the live or festival space, but also in the streaming space. Streaming services like Spotify and Apple Music very often will still run into issues where their hip-hop playlists, or this is especially the case with their country playlists, are primarily male artists, very few female artists. And even though more people are speaking out against that, the change has been relatively slow. If anything, it's been only really like incremental over the last like 4 or 5 years. So again, yeah, if anything, it's really important because it shows that it's not just a matter of having one major headlining performance that generates a ton of buzz. Like, that will not solve all your problems. There has to be like a consistent commitment to gender equality, that because of all these systemic issues in terms of who is still like gatekeeping in the music industry and what their biases are, a lot of those are still there.
Now, Sherry, one thing that's clear looking at the poster for this year's festival is how prominent solo artists are versus bands. Is that reflective of a greater trend?
Absolutely. Yes. I've been looking into this, not just for Coachella, but for a lot of other mainstream festivals in the U.S., like Lollapalooza and Bonnaroo, and just comparing the 2010 lineups for those festivals to 2019, and now looking at this lineup 2020, it's decreased significantly. So I think in 2010, they were festivals where you go see bands. And I think there's definitely a much wider narrative happening here about like the state of rock or adjacent genres. It was very much like a rock group festival. So back then, all those festivals had at least half of their lineups devoted to bands. And now, like, fast forwarding to here, for all these festivals across the board, it's a minority. Coachella and Bonnaroo are also around like 20-30%. In general, the rise of streaming has inherently rewarded or incentivized different kinds of music to come out. So like hip-hop is the most streamed genre in the U.S. right now. And so that leads to a lot of solo rappers coming up. In terms of like the person being centered, it's very much a lot more individualized now.
Now, what do you make of the prominence of certain artists on the billing? Looking at the poster, some really well-known visible artists like Lil Nas X and Carly Rae Jepsen on the third and fourth line.
I think this is such an interesting order. Yeah, to Lil Nas X specifically, I was also really surprised because every music publication in like their moments of the year, Old Town Road was like the defining moment of 2019. But I think he does only have one EP out. He doesn't actually have that much material out. So I'm actually curious to see like what his show will be like. Will he just like play the EP front to back? Maybe does he have more music out that he'll premiere at the show? I'm not sure, but that could be one reason, just like the catalog.
All right, finally, I'd love to know who you're most excited to see on the Coachella 2020 lineup and why.
So we talked about rock kind of as a genre that's in flux. I think another genre that's in flux is R&B, or at least it's a label that's in flux in terms of like what's the state of R&B. A lot of people, I think, have very old school associations with it, like from the 90s, early 2000s. And I think there are a lot of artists here on the lineup this year that are really trying to like reinvent and bring R&B back. So Daniel Caesar is definitely one, Ari Lennox, Summer Walker as well. And then of course, Frank Ocean.
Oh yeah, yep.
Who's like definitely one of the most popular artists in the R&B circle, despite not really releasing that much music at all.
Yeah, he's got this recluse thing going for him right now.
Absolutely. And people are still just fascinated exactly by this like mysterious aura around him.
He has a good way of making people pine for him.
I think it'll be really great and like will be a relief for a lot of people to see him headline a festival of this size.
If he shows up, who knows, right? I mean, what if he just doesn't go, right? Sherry Hu, a freelance music writer for Billboard and Forbes. Sherry, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
We gotta leave, take down some summertime. Just a night. I know you got someone coming. You're spitting game. Oh, you got it.
Kind of feel bad talking over Frank Ocean, but we're on social media at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm also there as well at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. You can also find us wherever you get your podcast. Just look for us there. We will be waiting to be heard by you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
Yeah.